I'm very glad that you're all here. Let me introduce you to our opponent first. This is Mark Thomas here. Mark Thomas is arguing that the Christian God does not exist. Now, Mark is the California Atheist State Director for American Atheists. He's on the advisory board member of Godless Americans Political Action Committee. He's the co-founder and president of Atheist of Silicon Valley, and he's the steering committee member of San Francisco Atheist. His website is www.godlessgeeks.com. And he will have some promotional material in the back. So he'll have some material available in the back after the debate if anybody is interested. Let's give Mark a big round of applause. Thank you very much, Mark. And arguing on the position of the existence of God is Bob Siegel. Bob Siegel is an evangelist, apologist, playwright, and dramatist. In 1979, he began the California ministry at the University of California at Santa Barbara. 5 years later, Bob changed from campus ministry to church planning. As a Harvest America minister, he started Sojourns Christian Fellowship, a campus church at the University of California, San Diego. In 1988, after 11 years in campus and church planning, Bob became a full-time traveling evangelist. Bob currently is a radio talk show host on KCBQ, which is 1170 AM, and KPRZ. His show airing Sundays, both of them KPRZ at 3 o'clock, KCBQ at 4. And he's also the author of the book, I Want to Believe in Jesus, But Why?, which will be available on sale in the back after this is all said and done. Let's all give Bob a big round of applause. The topic for our debate tonight is the existence of God. Now, we're going to say it general like that, but when we say the existence of God, we're speaking of the Christian God as explained in the Bible. So for throughout the rest of the night, unless otherwise stated, when we say the existence of God, we are talking about the Christian God as stated in the Bible. Now, the format for tonight's debate will be as following. There will be 15-minute opening statements from each of the opponents with a 10-minute first rebuttal to follow. There will then be 10 minutes each of cross-examinations, followed by a 5-minute second rebuttal and 5-minute closing statements. After the closing statements are all said and done, there will be a 30-minute period and 30 minutes and no more than 30 minutes of questions from the audience. Now, it's been decided among the candidates that Bob has been chosen to go first. So, Bob, let's give him a big round of applause and start this thing off.
Thank you. Thanks for coming out. One thing I want to mention, I did not grow up in the church. I was raised as a Jewish atheist. If that sounds like a contradiction in terms, it's not. Jews consider themselves to be a culture as well as a religion. And the only reason I mention my background is that I want you to know that if you're here tonight and you're not a Christian, a lot of the objections that you might have to Christianity I once had. My own people have been murdered in the name of Jesus Christ. I've had their synagogues burnt down in the name of Jesus Christ. So the hypocrisy of organized religion will stipulate that right away. I'm not going to argue that we don't see hypocrisy in religion, but we're holding up the person of Jesus, and it may interest you to know that Jesus hated religious hypocrisy more than any person in history and was executed because essentially the clergy of his day didn't like the fact that he was calling them whitewashed tombs with dead bones inside. And in the 7th chapter of Matthew, Jesus said that not everybody who claims to be a follower of his is going to enter the kingdom of heaven. So there are many people who call themselves Christians, do things in the name of Christianity, say things in the name of Christianity, and they do not actually have a relationship with God as Jesus defined it. That's pretty interesting that somebody would start a new movement and say, excuse me, I just want you to know that many of you, a lot of you who call yourselves followers of me, call yourselves Christians, call me Lord, Lord, on judgment day, I'm going to turn you away. Just thought you should know. Now, here's Judas with some announcements. It's not very likely that somebody's going to get up and say something like that. That's real painful honesty and quite a fulfillment of prophecy. We need to define a couple of definitions tonight, and the first is the word faith. People go to Webster's Dictionary and they read the word faith, and for this debate, it doesn't matter what Webster's Dictionary says. What matters is what the word faith meant 2,000 years ago in the New Testament days when the New Testament was written in Greek. And the word that they used for faith included belief, but essentially meant to trust, to cling to, rely upon, to obey. So it's simply not taught anywhere that somebody can just believe in Jesus and do anything they want. It's a relationship with God they're talking about. God does some supernatural things, but obedience is supposed to be the result, not perfectly. Nobody follows God perfectly, but it is a relationship. So here's what people usually think Christians mean when they use the word faith. I have no idea whether or not God exists at all. I have no idea whether or not Jesus is the Son of God, but hey, I know. I'll just pretend he does exist. I'll just believe in him whether he exists or not. Now, when I die, if it turns out that by chance I happen to be correct, then God will reward me for having been so gullible and stupid and having fried my brains and followed him blindly. That is not the definition of faith that the writers of the New Testament had. Their definition was quite different. They said to people, you can meet God. You can experience God. You can have a relationship with God that is genuine. They talked about the resurrection of Christ as though it was a historical fact. The reason they did that is because it was a historical fact. There hadn't been a lot of history yet by that time, but these people would tell you, hey, go check the archives of Pontius Pilate anytime you want. Find out for yourself. It was great, fantastic evidence. And then they said, knowing for a fact now that God exists, do you have faith to trust him to work in your life? Now, I'll give you an example. My friend Tom Pinkerton's on the front row here, and I'm going to talk about Tom for a minute. If I gave Tom a $1,000 check and asked him to deposit it in my bank account, it may take faith for me to believe that Tom will head for my bank instead of his bank. But I'm not going to doubt whether Tom exists. I'm not going to doubt whether I can see him and hear him and whether or not we had the conversation. See the difference? That's a very important difference. Because atheists all the time talk about the folly of blind faith. I agree. But that's not what's going on tonight. The next is the word evidence, and following that is the word proof. Frequently, Christians say, well, we can prove the existence of God, and then they don't do it. You cannot prove or disprove, I should say, the existence of God. Because nothing is provable unless it's repeatable and observable, unless you have experienced it yourself. Most of what we call facts in life do not come in the form of proof, but in the form of evidence. Evidence is that which points to a high probability that a given claim is true. If you're in a courtroom, you're going to make a decision based on eyewitnesses, testimonies, whether or not this guy robbed the 7-Eleven. But if you weren't actually there, even though they may tell you to make a decision beyond reasonable doubt, you can only do that so much. On the other hand, if you had been there, if you had eyewitnessed it, it would be different. Most of what we call facts in life come as evidence. Everything from history. People say to me, well, how do you know Jesus rose from the dead? You don't have a time machine. Well, how do you know George Washington crossed the Delaware? You don't have a time machine. There's as much evidence that Jesus rose from the dead as anything else we accept in ancient history and some other places in history as well. I'm going to be throwing out tonight a three-pronged argument. There are different kinds of evidence. There's what we call historical evidence. People might call it empirical evidence. And then there's also the evidence from philosophy. And I call this being rationally consistent. The rationalists, and there a lot of the original rationalists were Christians, I should say, or believed in God even if they weren't Christians. People today think you believe in God, you're over here, you're a rationalist, you're over there. Rationalists are people who believe that our mind has natural thought categories which seek to make sense out of life. And they will say if you can't be consistent with your own worldview, that's significant. It doesn't prove anything, it doesn't disprove anything, but it is significant. So I'm going to give an argument that says that the resurrection of Jesus Christ and the Bible is historically reliable, that the existence, and I am going to talk about the existence of some kind of God, but then when we merge it with history, then we'll see that this some kind of God actually was the God of the Bible, the God of Christianity. And then third, experiential. Ultimately, unless you actually have a relationship with God yourself, it will never be proven to you. I cannot prove to you and will not prove to you tonight that God exists. You can seek God in prayer and have it proven to yourself if God should reveal himself to you. That's where the rubber meets the road. What I can do, though, is if you're here tonight and you're saying, well, I have all kinds of reasons to not even take the time to pray because I think religion is ridiculous, then I can show you a little bit of the trail of breadcrumbs that God left you. That could bring us back to level ground, and you might say, oh, by golly, maybe there's more evidence for the existence of God than I thought. But if you don't actually encounter him, it won't matter. Raise your hand if you've ever been to Australia. Okay, more people than usual. Okay, this question is only for those who have not been to Australia. Does Australia exist? You've never been to Australia. How do you know? It could be a hoax. Maybe when you looked at photographs and films, they were filming some other place. Maybe they got kangaroos from the San Diego Zoo and were filming that. Maybe people fake. Maybe there's this incredible hoax. Okay, it sounds ridiculous, doesn't it? Technically, yeah, you haven't been there, but the likelihood that it's a hoax that there isn't in Australia is pretty amazing. And so my point then is that evidence, even though it may only be evidence and not proof, is very significant. Well, let's start with the historical evidence. First of all, there's a bias. If the same amount of eyewitnesses and testimonies and historians who claim that Jesus rose from the dead claim that a man named Jesus Christ started a revolution or gave a speech and that's all he did, nobody would doubt it. Nobody would doubt it because we have the same quality of evidence for the resurrection of Jesus. The reason people don't accept it is they say, well, it's talking about a miracle. And that's scientifically impossible. Really? When the Bible talks about miracles, they're not calling God a magician. They're not saying he waves a wand and sends science out the window. It's merely saying that there can be science we don't know about yet. There can be phenomena we don't yet know. If God established all scientific law, this same God could do his miracles with laws we have not yet discovered. Look what we discovered just in the 20th century. If somebody from the 20th century could go back through time, or if somebody from the first century could see an airplane or a rocket ship on the moon, or see you working on your computer terminal and surfing the internet, or see these tiny little images on this TV screen and wonder how the miniature people got inside, or heard a voice coming out of your cell phone, that would sound miraculous. We assume that it's not a miracle. We assume that, you know, we just learned science. We know that we learned some things about science. Now, 2,000 years ago, don't we just automatically assume that human beings will do things that will baffle our minds? But we don't believe they're going to do it by magic, do we? Well, if human beings can do that someday, why couldn't God already do that now? So an open mind would say, no, maybe there is a way to resurrect somebody from the dead. Scientifically, at the moment, we don't know how it could be done, but maybe it could. The only significant question historically is whether we have those kinds of eyewitnesses. Now I'm going to read a couple of quotations. This is from Luke. Now I know you read about him in the Bible, but he was an actual historian sponsored by a Roman dignitary named Theophilus to investigate Christianity. See if he's talking about blind faith. Many have undertaken to draw up an account of the things that have been fulfilled among us, just as they were handed down to us by those who from the first were eyewitnesses and servants of the word. Therefore, since I myself have carefully investigated everything from the beginning, it seemed good also to me to write an orderly account for you, O most excellent Theophilus. This was John, now, one of Jesus' disciples. That which was from the beginning, which we have heard, which we have seen with our eyes, which we have looked at and our hands have touched, this we proclaim concerning the word of life. Now people say, well, the New Testament doesn't count. You can't go by the writings of the disciples. Well, Luke, of course, was not a disciple, but the other three were. They don't count. I say, well, why not? Because they were biased. They liked Jesus. Okay, that's true, and in a moment I'm going to show you some people that were biased against Jesus and show you what they wrote about him. But do we really throw something out in history because of a bias? Winston Churchill wrote a multi-volume set called The Second World War. Does anybody believe that Winston Churchill, the Prime Minister of England, had an unbiased view of World War II? Probably not. Let me ask you a second question. Can any historian in his right mind be uninterested in a book about World War II written by Winston Churchill? You see, it depends how we ask the question. Here's what I always get. Show me just one person who can testify that Jesus lived and rose from the dead and did miracles. But the people that knew him, loved him, ate with him, slept with him, followed him around for 3 years, they don't count. That's a great historical test to set up. It doesn't wash that way. Having said that, let me tell you about a book called The Talmud. It was handed down orally. It's got 30, 40 volumes to it. And in the Talmud, we had some of the Jewish rabbis. Now, I told you I'm Jewish myself, so I'm not saying anything purposely negative about Judaism. But it says in the Talmud that Jesus Christ was executed on the charge of sorcery and apostasy. Now, apostasy meant heresy. He was arrested on the charge of apostasy because he claimed to be God. For a Jew to allow a man to claim to be God is the worst heresy that one can possibly imagine. Unless the guy happens to be telling the truth, and he actually was God, then it would be different. But they didn't believe he was God. But what fascinates me is they also called him a sorcerer. Why? Because in those days, if you didn't like somebody and you didn't want to follow him and you wanted to say negative things about him, but you could not deny the fact that he did miracles, you called it sorcery. You said, oh, he did it. Yeah, it was supernatural, but he did it by the power of Satan. So what we have now is a fantastic anti-Christian source with a bias predisposed against Jesus, which nevertheless says he lived, he was executed on the Passover, and he did miracles. Now, this is from Josephus, who lived at the time of the apostles. The apostles would have been, most of the apostles would have still been alive when he wrote. Josephus, we know for a fact, was not a Christian. He was a Jew, and he wrote this to a Roman audience. Now, there was about this time Jesus, a wise man, if it be lawful to call him a man. For he was a doer of wonderful works, a teacher of such men as received the truth with pleasure. He drew over to him both many of the Jews and many of the Gentiles. He was the Christ. And when Pilate, at the suggestion of the principal men amongst us, had condemned him to the cross, those that loved him at the first did not forsake him, for he appeared to them alive again at the third day, as the divine prophets had foretold, these and 10,000 other wonderful things concerning him, and the tribe of Christians so named for him are not extinct to this day. There's other historians, but we're running short of time. Rationally consistent. Rationally consistent. There's only three possibilities of how the universe got here. Either it always existed, or there was a time it did not exist, and it came into existence by accident, or it was put here by a creator or creators. At this stage, I do not automatically assume the Christian God. One of those three had to happen. Now, there are arguments for the existence of God that Christians have used that are not very good. But let me throw out a different one. If right and wrong is real, if you are not a moral relativist, if you really believe there's such a thing as good and evil, but you also believe you're here by accident, then there's an inconsistency. We put out a sign on college campuses that says, asks the question, is atheism consistent? And atheists come by all the time, and I should say, I have respect for atheists, and we have very friendly conversations. But they say, I'm an atheist, I'm not inconsistent. And what he means by that, or what she means by that, is I don't read the Bible, I don't go to church, I think religious people are stupid. I go, okay, I know you believe that, but have you ever thought about the implications of what would be true if God did not exist? You're inconsistent if you say there's no God, but you live as if there were. They say, but I don't live as though they were. I said, yes, you do, because you live your life as though you have meaning and value. If there were no God, we just invented meaning and value. So there really is no meaning and value, except that we could disagree on what it is. And what do you do then with morals? What if I walk to a moral relativist who didn't believe in God and pull the pencil out of his hand? He says, excuse me, that's my pencil. I say, yeah, I know, now it's mine. And if I'm bigger than you, we're not going to have a problem. And I wouldn't have been dumb enough to grab it out of your hand if you were bigger than me. Well, that's stealing. Yeah, it's stealing. So what? Well, that's against the law. Well, who made laws? A bunch of slop that accidentally evolved to a higher order, a bunch of accidents. As one accident to another, I don't think it's wrong. I'm not saying it's right. There is no right. There is no wrong. What is just is. And God's not here. So who's going to be the tiebreaker? Who's going to be the judge? Live and let live, man. Now, there are people who claim they believe that. You can go into college campuses today and in the classroom, they'll tell you, yeah, there's no such thing as morality. We invented morality. And it sounds good, but the minute you walk outside your classroom and somebody swiped your bicycle, you cry out in moral indignation. In fact, let me be a little bolder with this, and forgive me for getting so crass. If somebody broke into your household and raped and or murdered one of your loved ones right before your eyes, are you going to stand there and go, well, as one accident to another, of course we can't be dogmatic here. In my opinion, he shouldn't have raped and murdered. In my opinion, racism is wrong. In my opinion, slavery is wrong. But who am I to judge? In fact, that's what the South said to the North before the Civil War. Who are you to impose your morality on me? I talked to a student one time out at UCSD. He says, morality is relative. Morality is whatever a culture decides is right, is right. Just because they decide if it works, fine. I go, yeah? Well, slavery worked great. Slavery worked great in the pre-Civil War. And we'll talk to you more later.
So, Josh, you want to put up the first picture? No, the first picture, the picture. Okay, most people think that atheists are grumpy old, I don't know if you can read this, grumpy old men that just don't know what's going on. This is my attempt at humor to start us out here tonight. My name is Mark Thomas, and I'm an atheist. I'd like to thank the Slagels, and especially Justin here, for giving me a ride around. It's been a great day so far. I'd really like to thank the Christians for coming out to hear what must be a devil's advocate talk to them tonight. I'd especially like to thank the atheists for coming out and supporting me for this tonight. I am an atheist. When I was young, I was raised as a Methodist. My mother took me to Methodist school. I learned about God and Jesus and heaven and hell. I also knew about Santa Claus, but after a while I forgot about him and didn't believe him anymore. Because I had no reason to doubt what they taught me in church, it took me a lot longer to start to question God and Jesus about that. But as I started to look into it, I realized that there's no real evidence for either of them that we can find. God seems to me to be more of a Santa Claus for adults than any sort of real existing being. You know, sometimes I'd really like to believe in a God and a kind, benevolent Father that would keep watch over us, that would take care of us. Existential anxiety would be a lot less. Maybe I get to see my mother when I die. It sounds very nice, but to me, it just doesn't make any sense at all. The idea of God just isn't rational. It doesn't make any sense. So I'm an atheist. Atheism is simply the lack of belief in any God. I take the strong atheist position that depending on how we define God, we can prove that it doesn't exist. This atheism is not a belief. It is a conclusion based on facts and evidence, which Bob was kind enough to talk about tonight already. Atheists believe that reason and evidence, rather than religious faith, are the best sources of truth. The human intelligence, compassion, and experience are the best guides for our lives. My intention tonight is not to convince people that there is no God, that all gods are simply products of our minds. My intention tonight is to let you see that atheists have a rational basis for the conclusions that we have about how the universe works. I hope that you take neither of us as actual sources for information, that you go out and find your own evidence, that you look around, do your own research, and determine how you think the world really works. Most atheists and most Christians have much in common. Most atheists and Christians believe in love. We're good people. We believe in helping our fellow mankind and humankind. Most atheists and most Christians don't believe in most gods. We don't believe in Mithra. We don't believe in Zeus. We don't believe in Quetzalcoatl. We don't believe in any of the other thousands of gods that have been invented over the thousands of years by mankind. Where atheists and Christians do differ is belief in one specific God, the Christian God, also known as Yahweh, Jehovah, or just simply God with a capital G. I have seven reasons for concluding that the Christian God Yahweh does not exist. The first reason is that the typical definition of God, Yahweh, is logically inconsistent and describes a being that cannot exist. The second reason is that there is no need for any God to explain the workings of humans or the universe. The third reason is tied to the second reason. If Yahweh did exist, there would be measurable, verifiable evidence that would show that this God exists. The fourth reason is the moral failings of the Bible, the book of the supposed word of Yahweh. The fifth reason is the complete lack of evidence of reliable historical evidence for Jesus Christ, the Messiah of Yahweh. The sixth reason is the existence in the world of evil, both man-made and natural. The seventh reason is that all the arguments attempting to prove that Yahweh exists fail. The idea of an all-controlling, caring, supernatural God is a very attractive one. It can make our mortal lives less frightening, more comforting. Somebody's in control and won't let bad things happen to us. Yahweh also promises that when we go to heaven, that after we die and live in some sort of bliss. The idea of God is also an easy answer to the complexity of the universe and to the events that occur. Where did the universe come from? God made it. Where did life come from? God started it. Where did humans come from? Well, God created us too, and in his own image to boot. Why did it rain or not rain? Well, God did it. Why did somebody die? God took him home. Ultimately, though, It's not necessary for me to prove that Yahweh doesn't exist. It is up to Christians to prove that he does exist, because it is they that are maintaining that an invisible, non-material object exists. Just as though I were to tell you that tonight there is a 10-foot tall pink unicorn in this room and demand that you feed her. I would think that most of you would expect some sort of proof from me that this invisible unicorn exists. Thus, even if all the proofs of the non-existence of God were to fail, it would still be necessary to prove that Yahweh does exist if we expect to take this concept seriously. Some people say that we can't prove that a God doesn't exist, that to do so, we would have to have absolute knowledge. This is wrong. Depending on how we define God, it is possible to prove that it's self-contradictory and can't exist, just like it's possible to prove that square circles can't exist. Let's look at the attributes of Yahweh as commonly accepted. Yahweh is typically defined as having free will and being all-knowing, all-powerful, all-good, and eternal. Yahweh also created the universe and is separate from the physical world while still intervening in the physical world. After all, what good is a God that doesn't do anything? First, it's important to note that all these characteristics were made by humankind and have no real existence, much like the characteristics of Superman. Pretty much everything that we can say about Yahweh, we can also say about Zeus. People worshipped and prayed to Zeus. They felt Zeus in their hearts. They thought Zeus created and controlled the world. People died for Zeus. People killed for Zeus. Yahweh's typical qualities sound pretty good. Unfortunately, these attributes are mutually exclusive and can't exist in one being, no matter how supernatural it is. God can't have free will and be all-knowing. If God knows the future, God can't change it. Let's take an example. Let's say God predicts what the winning lottery numbers will be for tomorrow, writes them down on a piece of paper. Now God can't change that. God can't both know the future and change it. So God is not both omnipotent and all-knowing. The idea of God being all-knowing also brings into serious question the concepts of human free will and morality. If God knows what we are going to do, then we have no free will and are just characters in a play written by God. Without free will, morality makes no sense. Without free will or morality, any sort of punishment reward system loses any justification. Heaven and hell would just be places where God would put the souls that he had pre-created, bound either for heaven or hell. What tools can we use to determine the reality of the world around us? We have logic and we have empirical evidence. I maintain that logic and empirical evidence are all we have to determine the reality of the world around us. They've been extraordinarily successful for science and medicine that we've all come to rely on so much. This is the standard that most of us use when we go to a doctor for our health reasons, or when we have an engineer build a bridge. Why should we use anything less when we ourselves are examining the world around us? Tonight I'll be discussing ways of looking at the world and understanding it. I will talk about using logic and empirical evidence. Empirical refers to ideas that are capable of being verified or disproved by observation or experiment. Empirical evidence is not simply one type of evidence. It is the only evidence that we can rely on because it is reproducible. Empirical evidence is the basis for all physical science. The arguments for the existence of Yahweh fall into several areas. Because of limited time, I won't be able to discuss all of them. So I will talk about the most important ones. There's much to say, I only have limited time. After all, it's always easy for somebody to say, well, God did it. Unfortunately, scientific answers, rational answers, empirical answers take a lot longer to explain. The biggest weakness in using God to explain anything scientifically is that the explanation is not falsifiable. For any possible test we could do, we could simply say that God did it. There's no way to show that it's wrong. For every possible set of test and result, we could just simply say, God did it. Why does the earth and the universe appear to be so old? Well, God did it. Why did man come into being? Well, God did it. Why did anything happen? God did it. That's such an easy answer, but it's not the way that we should learn to look at the world. If we had stayed with God did it as the source of our understanding, we'd still be living in the dark ages. The idea of using God to explain the unknown is called the God of the gaps. The God of the gaps is the basic premise behind all the scientific explanations of God. And it goes something like this. This is the something that, say, Martin Luther could have used. Isn't lightning amazing? You know, I really don't understand how lightning could have come into being. How could it happen? Therefore, something else must be causing lightning. There's something else that I don't understand either, but it must be causing lightning. This something else must be a God, because I can't come up with a better explanation. Basically, they're saying once again that God did it. Well, as we all know, since the time of Martin Luther, we've come much closer to understanding how lightning works and how much of the rest of the universe works. The two main explanations for God, scientific explanations, are called first cause and intelligent design. First cause is basically God created the universe. It's also called the cosmological argument. It simply says that everything has a cause, and since we suppose it can't have an infinite number of causes, well then, once again, God did it. The main problem in the first cause argument is that the idea that every event has a cause. As we discover in the 20th century, quantum mechanics shows us that not everything has a cause. And this actually rules the universe at the very bottom level. In fact, we understand we have excellent scientific, empirical, and theoretical evidence showing how the universe could have come into existence on its own as a quantum event. This does not make sense in our normal everyday Newtonian experience of the world, but in the scientific, theoretical, and empirical evidence, it does make sense. The other first main problem with the first cause argument, as Bob was kind enough to talk about, is that we don't really know which God would have caused it. Every religion, just about every religion, has their God as the cause of the universe. The Romans thought that their gods did it. The Norse thought that their gods did it. Pretty much every god has created the universe. So we have no evidence about what sort of characteristics this god would have had. The other scientific bit of evidence is called intelligent design. It states that life on Earth is too complex and it must have had an intelligent designer. Intelligent design is a belief structure and not science, because there's no body of research to back it. And it's just a fancy god of the gaps, saying that we don't know exactly and precisely what happened, therefore God did it. Life is a process, not a design. It requires an explanation, not a designer. This explanation is the fact and theory of evolution. Evolution simply means change over time. It's a fact that enormous changes to life have occurred. The 3.5 billion year fossil record on the Earth is excellent evidence for this. The theory of evolution explains the processes that cause these changes. There are at least 8 areas of study and empirical data supporting the theory of evolution. They are fossils, the distribution of animals and plants, comparative anatomy, embryology, vestigial organs, which means organs that are left over that no longer have a function in us, natural selection, sexual selection, and genetics. I'll only deal later with a brief overview of fossils, vestigial organs, and natural selection and genetics. I think that's about my time. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mark. We are now moving in to our first rebuttal. 10 minutes for each of them. Bob, you have the floor.
Well, as I mentioned when I started, there are some arguments for the existence of God that are not very good. And I agree that some of the arguments that he was just giving are not very good. Intelligent design has some value to it, but yeah, it breaks down. It is interesting that the actual argument I gave for the existence of God, Mark has not commented on yet, but that was his opening statement, so I'll look forward to him getting to that in the rebuttal. But I do appreciate the fact that Mark verified some of what I said, because remember, where I was when I ran out of time is we live as though there is a God, even though we're not conscious of it. We live as though our life has meaning and value. And the evidence that our life has meaning and value is that we believe there's such a thing as right and wrong. If there is no God, there can be no right and wrong. And no, I'm not saying that if you don't read the Bible, you don't have a sense of morality. Atheists have a great sense of morality. You heard it from Mark. He says, apart from God, we should love, we should be good people, we should love all of mankind. We all heard him. I'm assuming he's not saying, well, in my opinion, we should love. If you don't want to love, that's okay. But that's what you'd have to do if you're an accident. You see, Mark doesn't really think he's an accident. He doesn't really live his life as though he's an accident. He lives as though human beings have value and that we should respect each other. Now, I do really like what Mark said, though, about the gaps. Every time there's something we can't explain, call it God. Yeah, and here are gaps. What makes a salmon swim upstream and find that one place where it was born so that it can die? Well, nature, evolution. I mean, we've observed that it happens. We don't explain it. Why is it that a chameleon lizard can change colors to match its surroundings? Well, it's, you know, it's not God. It's programmed right into the DNA. Yeah, but who programmed that? Well, nobody programmed it. I mean, evolution. So every time we can't explain something, we just call it evolution. Now, we're not debating evolution versus creation tonight. And there are scientists, real scientists, who could come in and do that. And they'd do a much better job than me. We're talking here about the God of the Bible. But let me tell you something. There are many people who believe in evolution and believe in God also. So let's, just for the sake of argument, let's stipulate that tonight. I know a lot of you don't believe in the theory of evolution. I don't either. I accept microevolution. I don't accept macroevolution. But let's just say it were true. Wouldn't that be a pretty incredible miracle that there's something in our DNA that allows us to adjust and adopt? You heard of the, you know, the Bible's always accused of being a fairy tale. You heard about the fairy tale of the frog that becomes a handsome prince? You give a frog to an evolutionist in a couple billion years, that frog will become a handsome prince too. But there are people who believe in evolution and also believe in God. They call themselves theistic evolutionists. And let me tell you the name of one of them, Charles Darwin. Charles Darwin believed in God, never set out to disprove God. He was merely looking at what he thought might have been the process God used. Now, it is true that later in his life, Darwin stopped believing in the biblical God and he did become an agnostic, which meant that he was at least still open to that. But it's also true that the reason he did that is that his daughter had died and he didn't understand why God let that happen. And I sympathize with that. I understand that. But that was an emotional reason. Charles Darwin, never on the basis of even his own science, and this is the dude we're always quoting from, never did he claim that he had disproved the existence of God. Now, we were told that the God in the Bible, as he's presented, is inconsistent. I'm a big believer in consistency. That's why I started talking about rational consistency at the beginning of the debate. One of the problems, supposedly, with the biblical God is, if God created us, who created God? That is a relevant question in the boundary of time and space. Outside of time and space, that is not a relevant question. Now, you heard Mark himself mention, right while he was up there, almost in the same breath, that we've learned through quantum physics that you don't have to have a beginning and an end. Quantum physicists are now talking about time. In fact, Einstein's theories of relativity have been verified through some interesting experiments. And the Bible, for years, was saying what Einstein eventually said. The Bible said that God was removed from time. Now, if God lives outside time and space, and I can't comprehend that, either can you, a being living outside time and space, by definition, would not have a beginning or an end. So if God was limited by time and space, that would be a very relevant question. Who created God? God is outside of time. And interestingly enough, time answers Mark's other concern about free will. It's an interesting argument. I've heard this. Let me say it again, because it's interesting. If God knows the future, he knows that someday in the future I'm going to go and have lunch in San Diego, and I'm going to go to the soup plantation, but I'm not going to eat any soup. I'm going to have a salad instead. God knew a million years ago that I was going to do that, then on the day I go to the soup plantation, I must eat the salad. Because if I eat the soup and God knew I would eat the salad, that would make God wrong. I think I'm fairly representing Mark's view. That view also assumes that God is limited by time and space. It assumes that neither I nor God are the constant of the universe, but this imaginary thing we call a timeline is. And that God looked into the future and saw that I would eat the salad someday as if he were looking in a crystal ball. But the Bible's conception of God is that God can look at all of time at a glance. This is what it means when it says that some of you Christians, that you're already resurrected, you're already in heaven, Jesus died for you before you sinned, because God is removed from time. And the reason he knew I was going to eat the salad is because he saw me eat the salad while I was eating the salad. But he saw everything else at the same time. So we don't really have a problem. Now I said, I'm not a scientist, but let me tell you about some people who are. Because people like to pit science against God. I just have a list here of some scientists, and I think their credentials are prestigious. They did a little more than getting an AA at Grossmont. Dr. Robert Jastrow, founder and director of NASA's Goddard Institute of Space Studies. Now, these men were not all Christians, and some of them believed in evolution, but they were theistic evolutionists. So at this point, we're saying that science has not told us that God cannot possibly exist. The historical evidence that I mentioned earlier would then get into the question of whether this God, whoever he is, would be the biblical God. Dr. Chandra Wickemeyer and Sir Fred Hoyle, two of Britain's most eminent scientists. Dr. Henri Marginet, professor of physics for over 40 years at Yale University, recipient of 8 honorary doctorate degrees, visiting professor at 123 universities, former editor of the American Journal of Science, Philosophy of Science Review of Modern Physics. Sir John Eccles, Nobel Prize laureate, internationally renowned neurobiologist, author of several noted books on the body-mind problem, as well as over 500 scientific papers. Dr. Rupert Sheldrake, former director of biochemistry at Cambridge University, a member of the Epiphany Philosophers' recent controversial book, A New Science of Life, was defended by a number of Nobel Prize laureates in Britain's Nature magazine. Dr. Stanley Jackie, one of the best-known philosopher historians of science in the world, was the 6th American to give the prestigious Gifford Lectures at the University of Edinburgh. And let me stop. There's many others, but let me stop with one that you might have heard of. He's a little bit remote, but some of you may have still heard of him. Albert Einstein. It's amazing. You can go to atheist websites and find Einstein's picture as if he's there. He wasn't a Christian. He wasn't a Christian. But he did say this: everyone who is seriously involved in the pursuit of science becomes convinced that a spirit is manifest in the laws of the universe, a spirit vastly superior to that of man, and one in the face of which we, with our modest powers, must feel humble. I did offer some evidence for the existence of God, and logic is a kind of evidence too. Mark said that logic was just as important. Logical consistency. I was telling you before that I was out at the university and I had a student tell me that he thought that there really wasn't any such thing as morality. And I said, well then, okay, whatever a society decides is okay. So the pre-Civil War society, that worked. If it was all based on survival. See, they have this thing called the wolf pack theory, which basically says what we're mistakenly calling morality is just this agreement that human beings made to survive. What we're mistakenly calling morality is an instinct for survival. I said, okay, so it was very convenient to the white people in the South to hold slaves. The slaves didn't like it. Now, why don't you go into your classroom? I said, because I don't believe that you really think slavery is okay. Well, why don't you go into your classroom and ask the teacher if you can have just a couple of minutes, and don't tell them we were discussing religion and philosophy. Just stand up, look them in the eye, and say, I want you to all know something about me. I believe that in the pre-Civil War South, the North should have just stayed out of it. And there was absolutely nothing wrong with slavery. There was nothing right about it, but there is no right and wrong. Are you willing to go do that? He goes, yeah. Yeah, I'll go do that. I said, fine, I'll be out here tomorrow, same book table. And if you tell me you do that, I won't call you a liar. I'll be out here at 1 o'clock. I never saw him again. I'll eat my hat if he did that. he wanted to win an argument, but he realized that day that he lived as though there are certain things that are right and wrong. More correctly, one thing is you would have people treat you, treat them. I know Mark believes that. He told you he does. Thank you.
Well, Bob and I, and probably most of you, all of you, are in agreement on one thing. Morality is important. Morality is very important. How do we interact with each other? How do we deal with each other? So the question is, where do we get our morality? Bob seems to be putting forth the position we get our morality from God. How do we know what God actually says? Has any of you actually gotten the word of God that you find is incontrovertible, that you could say, God told me this, and I can prove it to anybody else? Has anybody? I haven't either. So we're left with a source. Where do we get the source of God, of what his words are? Well, we can get them from somebody else, from divine inspiration, either from yourself or somebody else. If it's from somebody else, it's merely secondhand knowledge, and we don't really know. If it's even from yourself, how do you know that that's the actual divine word of God? Most people say, well, we get it from the Bible. The Bible is the good book. It tells us the answers. Have you ever read the Bible? I've read parts, but I haven't taken the time to read all of it. I find it largely pretty boring. And there's a lot of horrible stuff in the Bible where God condones killing, raping, murdering. It's terrible stuff. God killed almost everybody on the planet in one story that you all know, except for a few of them that live. God condones the rape and slaughter of many people. There's even one point where they talk about slicing pregnant women open. So much for God being against abortion. The Bible is touted by many as a source of ultimate knowledge and morality. Have you even read the Ten Commandments? How many of you know how many sets of Ten Commandments there are in the Bible? There's three sets. Two of them are very similar, the ones we typically know. But very, very rarely do we actually get the full ten sets of Ten Commandments. Usually we get the abbreviated version. In the more popular set, it says that people can be punished for the sins of their great-grandparents. I don't know about you, but I don't know what my great-grandparents might have done to piss off any sort of a God. So we're faced with, where do we get this morality? Where do we get morality? Bob and I both agree, and as I said, all of us agree, morality is important. So do we get it out of the Bible? I don't think it's a very reliable source for morality. So we're faced with, we get it out of a mutual agreement. We decide among each other that we give ourselves worth. I give myself worth, I give you worth, you give me worth, and we create morality out of that. It comes out of basic human kindness. On that, we can build morality. I look at biblical-based laws as antiquated. So I'm asking you, if you want, to help us build a new morality where we base it on mutual love and respect, not simply rules. What are rules? If you're speeding down the freeway, what keeps you from going faster? Typically, it's a rule that says, if you speed, you can get caught and get punishment. The Bible has something similar. It says, God is bigger and stronger than you, and if you break his rules, he's going to send you to hell. He's going to give you the ultimate punishment. So the morality of the Bible is just basically based on the concept that God is bigger and stronger than you and can punish you for breaking his laws. The morality that humanists and atheists are putting forth is a morality based on mutual love and respect, and I think is a much more powerful morality for which to base it. Bob talked about the Civil War and the South before the Civil War. Many people were understandably perturbed about slavery. So they would ask their preachers or priests about slavery. They felt there might be something wrong with slavery. The preachers and priests told them that the Bible condones slavery, and it does. There are many quotes in the Bible, I think about 20 or 30, directly talking about slavery. In one story, Jesus even tells about cutting a slave into little tiny pieces for disobeying his master. To me, that's not very moral. How should we treat our children? On the flight down today, I was delighted. There was this little girl in front of me. She was 20 months old. She's just delightful. And it brought forth in me feelings of love and compassion that I think is what is the basis for humankind. We all come from a long line of ancestors that loved their offspring, loved them enough at least to give them a real start in life. Any ancestors that didn't do this would typically die off rather quickly. So love is, in a way, programmed into our genes, as is mutual respect. Any small tribe, not too long ago, our ancestors lived in small tribes. Any tribe that didn't cooperate, any members that didn't cooperate, wouldn't survive very well in the tribe. So there's a very strong evolutionary push towards mutual respect and love within the tribe. To me, the God of the Bible is more of a schizophrenic, mass-murdering tyrant than a paragon of moral virtue because of all the murdering that God seems to condone in the Bible. And Satan comes off as a good guy. After all, how many people did Satan kill in the Bible? What about the historical veracity of the Bible? People say that archaeological evidence shows that some places and people mentioned the Bible really existed. Therefore, the Bible is true. This is like saying, well, the Civil War happened, therefore, Gone with the Wind, or excuse me, excuse me, that the, yeah, Gone with the Wind, yes, the Gone with the Wind has actually occurred. Let's look at one purported incident of the Bible, the slaughters of the innocent, where King Herod demanded that all babies under a certain age be killed. That is not recorded anywhere in the Christian Bible. I said I was going to talk about the lack of historical evidence for Jesus Christ. Of the time that he's purported to have been alive, there is no reliable historian, none, that wrote about him. He may have existed, he may not, but he definitely didn't make any impact on any historians of the time. All the writings that we have that actually relate to his life come from much later. The Gospels come from 65 to 95 AD, long after the supposed death of Jesus Christ. Now, because I was raised as a Christian, this took me a while to wrap my head around it. Because I'd always thought, well, Jesus really existed, and as an atheist, he may have been a good man, he may not. But, yeah, he's pretty much known historically. There is no historical evidence, no reliable historical evidence that Jesus ever existed. All the Gospels had obvious religious and political motives for putting it. The problem is we tend to view history back through the telescope of time, seeing it through the eyes of the latter part of the first century. Some people say, well, Paul wrote about Jesus. If you actually read the writings of Paul, to Paul, Jesus was just this sky god who existed up in the sky. Paul never talks about making any pilgrimages to where Jesus would have existed. Paul never really talks about Jesus as a mortal human being. To Paul, once again, Jesus was a sky god. In addition, Paul was from the town of Tarsus, as many of you might know. His original name was Saul. Tarsus was, at the time, the center for Mithraism. Mithra was a god that had been around for about 2,000 years. Mithra had 12 disciples. Mithra was born in a cave where shepherds watched him being born. Many wise men came to bring him gifts. Mithra performed miracles during his life. Mithra died in the springtime. Mithra rose into heaven and sits next to God where he judges the dead. Sound familiar? So Paul, who wrote about, I think it's two-thirds or three-quarters of the New Testament, I think largely influenced what Christianity become today, what we view Christianity is. There's a real problem in the world, and that's evil. We all know evil happens. We have just recently the floods in New Orleans. We have the tsunami on December 26th. How good a kind, loving God allow such things to happen? How can anybody allow such things as 9/11 to happen? I don't understand that. Let's look at what happens when people claim to get morality from God. I say that such people don't have morality. What they have is a code of obedience, which is not the same. God says what is supposedly moral, and they obey. If God were to say that lying, cheating, and stealing were moral, if you were good Christians and actually obeyed God, you would have to lie, cheat, and steal in order to obey God, because that would be moral. Actually, this is exactly what is happening right now in parts of the world, where the suicide bombers in different parts killing off people. They think that they're acting under the will of God. I disagree with them, but they are absolutely convinced that they are. If you believe in the absolute power of faith, if you believe in faith, how can you say that their God is wrong in telling them and your God is right? Thank you.
The next section we're going to be entering into is the cross-examination, which will consist of 10 minutes for each opponent to ask the other opponent questions. They will then discourse back and forth, and at 10 minutes I will cut them off and we will move to the other opponents asking the questions, and we will begin with Bob.
Mark, you were talking about the fact that the historians that lived at the same time as Jesus didn't write about him. Isn't it true that the reason we call something history is it because it happened quite some time ago? What interest would a historian in Rome have had of some carpenter living in ancient Palestine? Isn't it also true that Josephus, who was born right around the time Christ died, was a contemporary of the apostles and wrote about him not too long after? And isn't it also true, well, let me let you respond to that. Go ahead.
We're going to do question and answer.
Yeah, period. This is question.
I'm actually surprised that you're using Josephus. Most academics agree that that section of Josephus was inserted later on. For Josephus as a Jew to actually say that Christ, that Jesus was the Messiah, would be antithetical to him as a Jew. The section, if you read the section, you can find it on the web, many places. It's all the Antiquities of the Jews, as I recall. Josephus goes on, this terrible thing happened to the Jews, this terrible thing happened to the Jews, this terrible thing happened to the Jews. He has this paragraph about Jesus being this great and wise man. Then he goes back in the next paragraph, referring to the previous paragraph before the article on Jesus. What it's largely assumed is that this article, this section, this paragraph on Jesus was inserted by a later transcriber.
Okay.
Secondly,
okay.
For Josephus, even if he had written it, he's writing it in second person. He never saw Jesus. He wrote it at least after 70 A.D.
Okay,
so,
but you were saying...
So he's not a reliable historian.
Wait.
For that point. Because
any historian is going to write after it happened. Otherwise, we'd call him an eyewitness, not a historian. Mm-hmm. Also, it's not true that all scholars reject that passage. Most scholars accept most of it. Some scholars accept all of it. And merely saying that scholars say this or scholars say that when scholars are on both sides of the issue doesn't help us. We have to look at the reasons. Are you aware of the reasons they say that? There's nothing wrong with the context of it. He was talking about the deeds of Pontius Pilate. Now, where else is he going to put the execution of Jesus Christ but in the deeds of Pontius Pilate? He called Jesus the Messiah, but he was writing for a Roman audience. The term Christ to a Jew would have meant the Messiah. To the Romans, it would just be discussing which Christ, which Jesus he's talking about. Josephus talked about 14 different Jesuses because it was a common name. By calling him Christ, he could merely be pointing out which Christ he's talking about. There's another writer, and there were other historians. Tacitus, the Roman historian, definitely was not a Christian. He referred to the Christ, this person that Christians called the Christ. No scholar doubts that Tacitus wrote that, and nobody claims that Tacitus was a Christian because he called him a Christ.
Tacitus wrote that, as I recall, around the year 100.
Yeah, and that is not considered a lot of time.
This is a long time. In a society that is semi-literate, that believes in supernatural events happening all the time.
Mm-hmm.
This is not a society like we live in. We have to understand this is a society where myths can grow very rapidly. There are many myths of the time that grew out of the time. And when historians look at this, you can read for yourselves. Everybody can go to the web and read this article and see how that the article on Josephus, this paragraph that Josephus wrote, he didn't call him Christ, he called him Christus. In this actual writing.
Greek, Christ is Christos,
But to me, it's an obvious, we don't have the original writings of Josephus. We don't have it actually in his hand. So all we have are transcriptions. It's largely thought that this was an insertion, especially if you look at the other Christians later on. It's thought that it was inserted around 200 or 300 AD because Christians before then didn't refer to it. Suddenly it starts popping up. Christian references, this writing of Josephus. That's why it's largely perceived as a forgery, this one section.
Okay, we're both used to talking, I realize that, but we do have to try to keep this a dialogue. Do you believe that Aristotle was a myth, or did he really exist?
There's excellent evidence for Aristotle having existed.
Okay, are you aware that from the time Aristotle lived and wrote to the earliest copy of an Aristotle manuscript, we have a time gap of 1,400 years? See, when you make an issue that we only have the copies of Josephus, mm-hmm. that's true of every piece of history in the ancient world. Now, you can throw out all the history and say none of it's reliable, but unfortunately, you refer to it on your website, so you can't do that. Or we can say, look, the evidence for Jesus is just as good as any other evidence that we accept. We have to do that with history. That's why we're calling it historical evidence. That's why I'm willing to say that it's not proof, but don't we accept historical evidence all the time? If you can accept Aristotle with a 1,400-year gap, from the time the New Testament was written to the earliest New Testament manuscripts, we have only about 200 years, and we have some papyrus fragments within 30 years. Now, when people look at that and go, oh, look what we could have lost in 30 years, but then we go to Aristotle and go, oh, well, 1,400 years. You know, people that study the ancient world will tell you that even 1,400 years is not that long of a time, given how careful people were copying it. I'll let you respond.
Aristotle didn't claim to do magic. Aristotle, we have excellent evidence for.
But so you're admitting that there's a bias. You're admitting that you're not going to give it the same historical test you would give anything else.
When historians attempt to show what happened in history, they have to look and say, what is reliable? What is historical evidence? They don't say that supernatural events occurred.
So
this is standard method.
Well, I know. I've heard this, that extraordinary claims need extraordinary methods. But the minute we say we're going to use extraordinary methods, we're admitting that we're not using an objective method.
That's objective.
You don't know what historical objective methods are for history? Mm-hmm. The amount of eyewitnesses, the amount of manuscripts, the amount of personal testimonies, the amount of historians, the influence, the change.
Okay. So we can go back to Jesus. Exactly what reliable eyewitnesses do we have that we know who they were, that they weren't simply a scribe? Now, the Bible was put together, it was the Council of Nicaea?
The Council of Chalcedon, the Council of
Corinth. It was around 300, three or 400
AD. That's not when it was written.
So that's when it was put together. At that time, they put on these names. They didn't know, some of them, they didn't really know who had written it. So the problem is that we don't really have a historical basis for knowing that these authors actually existed.
Okay, let me respond. They did know who wrote them because the second century fathers, people who knew the apostles, wrote about them. We have so much commentary of the New Testament in just the second century that you could almost reproduce it just from the commentaries. Okay. Papias, for instance, was somebody who knew the Apostle John, and he lived about 130 AD. It's true that the Council of Carthage assembled the Bible for the first time, but their criteria was that they did an investigative study of who the second century people who knew the apostles were. And you could read the writings of Papias and Irenaeus, and they will tell you that Mark wrote the Gospel of Mark, and he was an associate of Peter. They'll tell you that Matthew wrote Matthew. John wrote John. The only reason it took them a long time to assemble it is because when you're hiding in catacombs from the Romans, you don't have time to call a worldwide church ecumenical council. When they finally had a chance to breathe, they assembled them all together.
We've gotten a little distracted. I'm not completely disputing that there may have been a person at the center of the Jesus story. I don't know for sure. My point is that from my vantage point, we don't have reliable historical evidence that Jesus existed. That is, however, our debate tonight is not over the existence of Jesus.
You said it's over the existence of the Christian God. That's who
Jesus, the Christian God.
And that's who Jesus claimed to be. That's the Christian God.
That is one of the parts of the Christian God. The Christian God obviously has many other
points. Okay, so we're doing this part right now.
Yeah, okay.
What would it take for you to consider Jesus reliable, aside from saying that he would have had to not do miracles?
Well, I don't know about Jesus. I can tell you about God.
Well,
for me to believe in God?
Well, why don't you answer the question about Jesus, and then you can tell me about God.
There'd have to be some sort of reliable historical evidence that he actually existed.
And I did not list that. Tacitus, the Roman historian. Josephus, historian.
Josephus is widely disputed.
Peter, who was an eyewitness, John, who was an eyewitness, Luke, who was another historian.
I dispute that we actually know that those were the authors.
The Jewish. And you dispute that on what basis? How do you know they weren't the authors?
That we don't know for sure. I mean, I am not a historian. Okay. All I can do is base my, and all you can do, and all anybody can do, is base their concept of what happened based on what other people wrote, what other people say.
And that's what we have to do with anything of history. Thank you.
Okay.
You now have 10 minutes to question Bob.
Sure. First, you said that Darwin was at most an agnostic.
Late in his life, he was a Christian before then.
Well, he was a Christian in the early part of his life. He was thinking about becoming, as I recall, a country preacher, basically.
Yeah, he went to divinity school.
Sinecure was the point. Yeah. Until he went off and did the tour on the Beagle. And then he started to understand the complexity of life and how it came about. You have already agreed to accept evolution as a process that has occurred, that is occurring.
I've agreed that hypothetically it could be a process for the sake of tonight, but that there are theistic evolutionists, and that even if we got here through evolution, evolution does not explain things. You do the same, what you're saying that Christians do with the gaps, you do with evolution. I could ask you where consciousness came from, and all you'll be able to tell me is evolution. You won't really be able to explain how a thinking, feeling, sentient entity at one point evolved out of dusts and planets and electricity and amino acids. You could say that's a gap.
We have excellent evidence that shows that amino acids form easily, both in our environment here on prebiotic Earth.
Yeah, but that wasn't my question.
You're asking me a question, so it takes time to work
this
out.
You're right. Go ahead.
We can just say God did it, and it's over.
And we could just say evolution did it, and it's over.
But I can explain evolution.
Okay, please
I can
do.
Explain evolution.
Please
I
explain
can,
how thought okay. came from non-thought.
Thought is what it called an emergent property. Okay? Just as we have a computer, we can create a program that goes into the computer. It's an emergent property that the computer
right,
programs.
Because the computer came from our thoughts.
It is a poor analogy, admittedly. A consciousness is a whole separate point that we haven't gotten into.
Well, actually, I think the computer was a very good analogy, because if we could not make computers.
As I said, it's a poor analogy.
Oh, okay.
Okay. Thought is an emergent property.
Okay.
I have a dog. Many of you have pets. Dogs think. They don't think heavy philosophical thoughts, but I've seen him contemplating, should I chase that cat or not? How about that squirrel? Can I make it to it or not? He's not creating great thoughts, but he's thinking. We have a basic brain, much like a dog in us. We also have a more complex brain, so we can do more complex things. Hidden within our brain is a reptilian brain that handles more basic functions. So our brains are just an evolved process that comes into being. If there were a intelligent designer, let's take a look at image number 11 there, Josh.
This is, this is your questions for me? Why are these slide presentations questions?
You're bringing about evolution. Okay, so I need to show that we are not intelligently designed. If we were designed by a god, he could come up with this is a little design of the eye.
Is this going to explain to us where thought came from?
No, this is going to explain.
Well, that was.
This is going to explain where the eye came from and show that it's not intelligently designed.
Okay.
Okay. Now, in the back of the eye, we have the retina. Let's go to 12. This will be on the inside of our eye, on the back. Light comes in from the top. It goes down through the top seven layers of cells. Down at the bottom are the light-sensing organs, the light-sensing parts of the cells, where the signal goes back up to the surface, goes along the surface of the inside of the eye, and leaves through the optic nerve. It's not a great design. It works. It works quite well, but it's not a great design. For a truly intelligent designer, he would have designed it much like the octopus or the squid, where we have this whole situation reversed, where the light-sensing cells are on the surface of the inside of the eye.
So the octopus and the squid looks like it was designed then.
They're much better. They're dealing in lower light. Okay, but ours aren't. If we're going to say that's intelligent design.
No, Mark, it's a very interesting presentation, and for you to put it together, I assumed you used your eyesight. Your eyes seem to be working pretty good to me.
They work well
However
enough.
However God did it, it seems to work.
It works well enough, but it's not perfectly designed. We could see better. I don't know about you, but my eyes aren't perfectly designed. I imagine a lot of you are wearing contacts or glasses. Obviously, our eyes don't work perfectly. A couple other things you talked about.
Now, this will be a question.
Yeah, this is a question. Okay. You talked about Einstein believing in God. Einstein did not believe in a personal God. He wrote an extensive article. In fact, the quote that you got that from, where he talks about not believing in a personal God. Unfortunately, I missed the quote here.
He said some kind of manifest spirit.
Right.
He may not have gotten detail.
He said he does not believe in a personal God.
I mentioned right when I made the quote that he was not a Christian and he didn't believe in the Bible, but he did believe that some kind of intelligent spirit was responsible for this universe. And he said it very clearly.
Yeah, once again, you're quoting a lot of scientists. Now, if we were to go to the National Academy of Sciences, probably the highest, most prestigious organization of scientists in our nation, Only about 7% of them believe in a personal God. Most of them don't.
So I've looked at a survey. It was printed in Nature magazine, and the question they actually asked them was, do you believe in a God who answers prayer? Now, depending on where they are or are not with God, you're going to get different answers. If they had said, do you think it's possible that there's some kind of thinking, feeling, sentient, intelligent consciousness that can we can attribute all this complexity in our universe to, they might have gotten a different answer. Polls can be very deceiving. It depends on how the question is asked.
That is true. Okay. But the bottom line is they don't believe in a Christian God.
No, but once you believe there's some kind of God, then you're more open to say, by golly, then the resurrection might not be impossible. Okay. Then Josephus and Tacitus and the historians start to fall into place.
We're arguing for the Christian God. We're not arguing for a generic God.
But you would start by saying, because you said yourself, we have to use empiricism and logic. Mm-hmm. So the logic says, is it logical that there's a God? Yeah, well, even Einstein thought so. Next, is this God the Christian God?
Okay.
Well, the testimonies and the historical reliability of the resurrection would suggest that it is the Christian God. I think that makes sense. I don't see anything. Please show me where that's irrational.
The resurrection's irrational?
Please tell me where the resurrection is irrational based on what I just said.
We all know that dead bodies don't come back to life. That virgins don't give birth after being impregnated by a Holy Spirit.
And you know that how exactly?
What? We have absolutely no evidence that it happens.
So the absence of evidence is evidence of absence. They knew 100 years ago that you couldn't split the atom, and today the atom is being split. They knew 2,000 years ago a TV set would have looked like
that,
a miracle.
That's no argument. We know that dead bodies don't come back to life. Once
we
the
have
body
not,
starts to decay.
Maybe you haven't observed it yet, but is it possible that God can do some things that science has not yet discovered? That's not even possible?
That's arguing just the possibility.
Well, but you said you like evidence. The evidence of science, if science has shown us one thing, is that what we frequently think is impossible becomes very possible. Because we're doing things in science now that people would have thought were impossible.
So you're claiming that hypothetically, maybe sometime in the future, we could take a body that's been dead for a day and a half and bring it back to life.
Absolutely. And I'm claiming that God, if we could do that someday, maybe God can do it now. So it's not magic. God is using scientific laws that we don't know. It would be very difficult, Mark, not to at least consider that possibility.
I have considered. The possibility for a dead body that is physically decaying to come back to life, even for a dead cell to come back to life, is astronomically impossible.
Because you have not yet observed it.
Let's take a piece of meat.
In AD 33 did observe it.
We have no reliable evidence that it did.
But I showed you the reliable evidence, and your circular reasoning says it's unreliable only because it's a mirror.
Once again, the Jesus that supposedly is the salvation of mankind did not even create enough of a bump in the historians of his time for them to note him. The story did not come to life until 30, 40, 50 years later, in a time when many, many miracles were thought to have occurred, when myths grew up very, very rapidly in the time.
Pliny the Younger in 120 AD said they were already calling Jesus God. That amount of time is not enough time for a myth to develop. Ask anybody that studies mythology. Anyway, I appreciate Mark. And Mark, I know we're both used to talking. We're kind of talking over each other. That's why we have these times where we talk to the audience. I do want to apologize for any time I interrupted. And I thank you for coming tonight. Now we're kind of leapfrogging back because I'm talking about things that Mark said in his first rebuttal, and this is my second rebuttal. He asked if anybody had actually heard God's voice. Now, I didn't want to be rude because if I had raised my hand, then I would have taken the focus off of Mark. So I'll raise my hand now. I have actually heard God's voice, and so have some other people. So we're not claiming we can prove that. Those of you that have not heard God, we're not claiming, and I'm not saying that to be a Christian you have to hear God's voice either. And I'm not saying I've even heard it often. But I have heard it, and it was very significant when I did. Mark mentioned that God commanded people to rape women. That is simply not true. Now, it is true that God did command the Israelites to attack the peoples that already lived in Canaan. And it is true that when prisoners of war were taken, in those days, they didn't have agencies that protected the rights of women. The Bible does come out of a very chauvinistic culture. The Apostle Paul actually did a lot of things to liberate women. But the Bible came out of a very chauvinistic culture. And in those days, and God was working with that culture, if a woman was captured in war, she became a wife, or she became a concubine, which was a wife with a lower status, or she became a prostitute. The only merciful thing people could do was take the women into their homes. But because they became wives, they had sexual relations, so people look at that and they call it a rape. So you don't read the word rape in the Bible, you read articles that talk about the Bible writing the word rape. The Bible does not say that children suffer for the sins of their parents. Deuteronomy 24 says children do not suffer for the sins of their parents. Ezekiel 16 says children do not suffer for the sins of their parents. In the Ten Commandments, God does say that I visit the iniquity to the third and fourth generation. The ancient Hebrews spoke with a lot of hyperbole and exaggerated phrases, and it was their way of saying that when God removes his restraining hand, sin can take its course. Children have a tendency to be like their parents. They have a tendency to have their parents' weaknesses. I have some of my parents' weaknesses. My children have some of my weaknesses. And because the Hebrews viewed God as being ultimately sovereign, they would say that God visited the iniquity. But what they meant by that was that God allowed that to happen. Mark mentioned that slavery is condemned nowhere in the Bible. Slavery is condemned in 1 Timothy chapter 1, where slave trading is called an evil. The Apostle Paul in 1 Corinthians chapter 7 encouraged slaves that if there was any way they could peacefully gain their freedom, and there was a way to peacefully let a slave go, do it, should do so. In the book of Galatians, it says that out in the church, there is outside of the church, there's slave nor free, but here in the church, we are not going to recognize any such status. And masters such as Philemon, and you can read about him in the book of Philemon, were encouraged to let his slave Onesimus go. Mark mentioned that Jesus told a parable about a guy cutting somebody up. It was a parable. He was telling a story. Hebrew parables had one message, one moral, and the moral of that story was not go around cutting people up. This is the same Jesus that said, put down the sword, I did not come to bring a sword. Mark mentioned that King Herod massacred some babies according to the Bible, but we don't read about this massacre in other history. First of all, it could have been written about in history that has been lost to us, but Josephus and other historians do write about all kinds of massacres that Herod did. Many of them were even in his own family and children. There was a quote that said, I'd rather be one of Herod's pigs than a member of his family because he loved his pets more than his family. So certainly what we read in Matthew is consistent, very consistent with Herod. And a little tiny village in Bethlehem may be important to us because we sing about it at Christmas time. But in those days and right after those days, the Romans, they might not have known. And it doesn't even say how many of the children were massacred. It just might not have been that big of a news in those days. But it certainly fits Herod in the way that we describe him.
2 minutes.
How much time do I have? Okay. I think I'm done. Can I borrow 2 minutes later?
Thanks. The God of the Bible is a terrible creature. He kills large numbers of people. He killed everybody at one point, as I talked about before. This is not a God to me to worship. This is not a God to me to pray for. And if you believe in the three in one, a triunal God, Jesus was also part of this killing. The morality of the Bible, I think, is a morality of the time. In fact, Bob even alluded to that. When Jesus told a parable, he told a story about a master cutting his slave into little tiny pieces for not obeying the will of the master. To me, this is a horrible story. Why would a man who is supposedly a moral paragon to show the world how love and caring are so important, why would he tell a story that's as horrible as a master cutting his slave into little tiny pieces? What kind of morality is that? The Bible did talk about slave trading being evil, but it never really said that slavery itself was evil. The Ten Commandments never mention it. One of the third set of Ten Commandments, take pains to note that you shouldn't boil a baby goat in its mother's milk. But it never mentions that slavery is wrong or that beating children is wrong. In fact, it often condones beating of children. You all know the story, you know, spare the rod, spoil the child. To me, that's child abuse. The Bible never talks about that. That's the kind of morality that the Bible is putting forth. That's the kind of morality that I don't believe in. And I don't think most of you do. I would think that most of you loved your children, your parents loved you. Let's look at the quote from Albert Einstein. He wrote an article in 1930 New York Times. It goes, I cannot imagine a God who rewards in punishment the object of his creation, whose purposes are modeled after our own, a God, in short, who is but a reflection of human frailty. Neither can I believe that the individual survives the body, although feeble souls harbor such thoughts. through fear or ridiculous egotism. Now, Bob is putting forth the concept that the slaughter of the innocents might have occurred and just wasn't written about. Josephus delighted, as far as we can tell, in writing about the evils that King Herod had done, yet he never mentions this. So we have historical evidence right there that Bob is just simply begging away. Bob, you heard God's voice?
Are we dialoguing? Or are you
I'm just asking you a question. What did
he
sound like?
Would it make any difference to you if I told you what he sounded like?
It might. I'm just interested. I mean, I've never heard God speak to me, so I'm curious.
All you need to know is it was audible, and I heard it. And there were a lot of personal things he said to me. He spoke to
that
me.
I had an interesting experience a couple of days ago. I watched a woman walking along. She was talking to thin air until I realized she had a little wireless contraption right here. It was no doubt fixed to her cell phone. When we look at people walking along, talking to thin air, we tend to assume either they're talking to somebody in the cell phone or they're hallucinating in some way. Now, we all hallucinate. There's nothing wrong with it. We dream at night. We wake up in the night sometimes in a cold set. Things seem very real to us. How do we determine what reality is? We look to empirical evidence. We look to how we can actually show that to each other. Without that, we don't know what is real. I don't doubt that Bob had this experience. We all have similar experiences at some levels, dreams and whatever. How do we know what's real, though? We have to look to empirical evidence. That's the only real source of understanding reality. It's interesting that Bob referred to Hoyle as a God believer. Hoyle was a scientist who was pushing very heavily for what is called the steady state theory that has since been squashed in science in favor of the Big Bang theory. I don't have much time to get into the Big Bang, but we do have excellent evidence that goes back to a billionth to this portion of a second, a billionth of a billionth of a billionth of a billionth of a second after the Big Bang that our math and empirical evidence show. We haven't actually gotten back to the Big Bang itself, but quantum mechanics has only been around for about 100 years, as has relativity. And within that 100 years, we've come that close to understanding exactly how the Big Bang has occurred. There are excellent evidences that show actually how the Big Bang could have started, but we're still working on that. That's pretty much it. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mark. Thank you, Bob. It is now time for closing statements. The closing statements will work. It will be a 5-minute final statement from each of our participants. Once we're done with that, I have a couple quick announcements, and then we will get straight into the question and answer period from the audience. Bob.
Well, I mentioned in my opening statement that there were a three-pronged argument that I was going to use. That the resurrection of Christ is historically reliable, that the belief in some kind of deity is rationally consistent. I believe I demonstrated that, and I offered to give evidence. And then I said the proof is if you meet and encounter God. Now, in any debate and in any philosophy class, one of the things you learn about is circular reasoning. Now, let's go back. Let's all check our memories. Mark was up here, and he wanted to make a point. God can't be empirically observed. He was trying to make the point that if you actually heard God, then maybe you were a witness. Maybe you can't prove it to somebody else, but you could have proved it. And he said, how many of you have actually heard God speak? Because he's assuming that this is all a bunch of blind faith, even though I explained what the word faith really meant at the beginning. And so he said, how many of you have actually heard God speak? Now, when I claimed that I had heard God speak, he's now totally switching gears, and he's saying, oh, no. Well, if you think you heard God speak, then you must have been hallucinating. Well, he doesn't know that. You see, if I had said I didn't hear God speak, then he would have said, you see, blind faith. If I say I did hear God speak, oh, hallucination. In other words, he was asking a question of which he was not really open to the answer. Now, there are psychiatrists and psychologists who know a lot more about hallucinating than I do and than Mark does. Some of you may have heard of M. Scott Peck, who wrote a very famous book called The Road Less Traveled before he even became a Christian, an MD, a psychiatrist. He knows what a hallucination is. He knows what autosuggestion is. And people came into his office and he began to discover it's something supernatural and that they were demon-possessed. And this was a skeptical psychiatrist. There are other psychiatrists that are well known today that are Christians. John White, Associate Professor of Psychiatry at the University of Manitoba. Dr. Lloyd Antlum, Professor of Psychology, Stanislaus State University. Now, I did a debate with a man named Dan Barker, pretty well-known atheist out at Arizona State University a few years ago. And during the audience question and answer time, a lady stood up and she said, "I'm an atheist and I'm a psychologist and I have a question for Mr. Siegel." So I'm thinking, okay, well, I'm going to get it now. And I was amazed at her question. She says, "When my mother died, my sisters and I were at the funeral and we saw this figure. We saw this transparency, this ghost, and we didn't talk about it at the time, but we each saw it, and it was my sister. And on the way home in the car, we talked about it, and we admitted we all saw it." And she turns to me and she says, "Who are you to say that just because I'm an atheist, I don't believe in the supernatural?" Very bizarre question to get from an atheist. Probably some of you atheists would agree that that's a bizarre question. I said, "Well, I never said that." "Evidently, you do believe in the supernatural." Then my opponent, Dan Barker, says, "Oh, well, what you were experiencing at that point was autosuggestion." I said, "Dan, she's a psychologist. Don't you think she's better qualified than you and me to know what autosuggestion was?" Then she walked up to Dan, waved her finger at him, and said, "It was not autosuggestion." And she walked out. Well, I always found that a very interesting story. On the website from Silicon Valley, which Mark comes from, and I don't know that he wrote this, but it announced this debate, and I thought it was interesting the way they advertised it. They said there's going to be a debate between Bob Siegel and Mark Thomas, and then they wrote, "True believers, of course, will not be swayed by logic or facts." Well, I think Mark's a true believer that God doesn't exist. I think Mark's a nice guy. I like him. We both love Star Trek. That's something we have in common, so we're friends, you know, we're like the two attorneys that go at it and then afterwards say, "Great job, golf on Friday." So Mark, you're a nice guy. But I do believe you heard some logic. I do believe you heard some facts. And I do believe you were still swayed by your own beliefs and you didn't listen to them. Thank you.
So we've had a little fun tonight talking about some ideas. I hope it gets some of you thinking about looking at the world around us, about who actually does control things. Do we want to follow an invisible spirit that tells people to fly, or at least to them, fly planes into buildings? Or do we want to look at creating our own morality out of love, care, and compassion? Do we want to build a morality based on a book that tells where God, the omniscient, the omnipotent, the all-loving, kills people for his own reasons, a God whose morality is based basically on rule, just like speeding on the freeway? God basically tells you to do something, not because it's really good for you, not because it's really good for other people, but basically because if you do it, you go to heaven. If not, he'll kick your butt and send you to hell forever. That is not a God that I think should be worshipped. But we're not really talking about just the morality of God. We're talking about its actual existence. I think I've shown to you tonight the different concepts of God, why I think it doesn't really exist. I've shown how Yahweh is logically inconsistent, how there's no need for a God to explain the universe. We really didn't get into time for that as much as I would have liked, for the evolution process to show how evolution explains how life has come about, how we're descended from previous living beings. How if Yahweh did exist, there'd be a measurable effect that we could see. Babies might come back to life after they died. Amputated limbs might come back and exist. No such magic that I know of exists, and I don't think anybody has really seen any true miracle that can't be explained in any way happen. I looked at the moral failings of the Bible, the fact that I think Bob skirted around. To me, the Bible has some good stuff in it and some bad stuff. It largely puts forth the science of people of the time. They viewed the world very simplistically. The earth was flat, there was a dome over it, with little holes in it, and this the firmament is what it was called, and it would let the celestial waters through. The fifth reason Bob disputes this, I think it's still pretty solid. The lack of reliable historical evidence for Jesus Christ, the Messiah of God, Yahweh. All the people who supposedly wrote the Gospels and other things, I think, were highly religiously and politically motivated. The Gospels were not written until much later in history, a time during which much mythology and supernaturalism was considered very normal. And the last reason, I don't think that any of the logic put forth by Bob actually conclusively proves that Yahweh exists. I would think if there were this supernatural being, there would be some empirical knowledge, experience of its existence. The atheist position is that the universe is understandable and explainable in naturalistic terms of science and mathematics. There's no need for a God to explain the universe or reliable evidence that any God exists, much less Yahweh. Atheist is more than just a belief paradigm. Is a conclusion based on evidence and logic. Richard Dawkins expressed it well. The universe that we observe has precisely the properties that we would expect if there is at bottom no design, no purpose, no evil, no good, nothing but pitiless indifference. Some people claim it takes more faith to be an atheist than to be a believer. This is false. All it takes to be an atheist is simple understanding of science and its conclusions and rational logic. For instance, atheists, like most people, don't believe that the sun's going to come up tomorrow. We conclude it based on past evidence. Many religious people ask how atheists can be happy without God. For me and for many atheists that I know, the realization of atheism has been extremely freeing and opened us to our own happiness. Atheism gives us the ability to see the universe as it actually is without mental filters or superstition preventing us from directly experiencing it. Atheism allows us to experience ourselves without the debasing idea that we are innately sinful. Atheist gives us the freedom to think for ourselves, to construct our own meanings. We can choose what we think has value. As I talked about for morality, we can choose that each of us loves and cares for each other. We are not ordered by some God under the threat of punishment of hell. We can simply love and care for each other. Atheism teaches us to treasure this life, this planet, and our future, because this is all we have. I would like to tell you the bad news and the good news. The bad news is that, as I see it, there is no God to watch over us and care for us. The good news is that there is no hell and that we can all love and care for each other if we so choose. The ancient Greek philosopher Epicurus summed it all well when he wrote about these ideas. Either God wants to abolish evil and cannot, or he can and does not want to. If he wants to but cannot, he is impotent. If he can but does not want to, he is wicked. If, as they say, God can abolish evil, and God really wants to, why is there evil in this world? I've shown that there is no reliable evidence for any God, especially Yahweh, and that it's reasonable to conclude that Yahweh does not exist. I've examined most of the standard reasons for belief and described how they collapse under the weight of real evidence, science, and logic. As I've shown, the concept of God is logically contradictory and is also unnecessary to explain the universe. God not only does not exist, but cannot exist. In short, God is impossible. Thanks.
Thank you, Mark. Thank you, Bob. That concludes the debate portion of the evening. Let's give both our candidates a big round of applause. Couple announcements I want to make now, but I will be making them again. Firstly, if you enjoy the debate and would like to take home a 2-CD audio presentation of the debate, that will be available shortly after for $5, and it will include the question and answer portions that we're yet to do. Also, Bob's book, I Want to Believe in Jesus, But Why, is available in the back on sale for $10, and if you can't do that today, you can also get it at Amazon.com. The question and answer period will work as follows. We will take questions, one question for Bob, and then one question for Mark. If you have a question for Bob, I'll say a question for Bob. You know, we'll call on somebody. There's two people with microphones in the back that will come up to you. You will ask the question. If it's directed at Bob, Bob would get a chance to come up here and answer it. After Bob is finished, then Mark would get a chance to come up here and answer that question or respond to that answer as well. And it will go 1-1-1. We'll do this for 30 minutes, and we'll get in as many questions as we can. We understand that this has, you know, been a long night. If there's people with kids, babysitters, kids in the nursery, you can't stay, go ahead and just stand up. You can leave right now. No hard feelings for anyone. We just wanted to make that open so you weren't stuck here. But other than that, we will start with questions for Bob. So if anyone has a question for Bob, I'm going to go right here to this guy right here. What's your name, sir?
Rick.
Sarah's right behind you with a microphone.
It's a good thing I believe in God. actually, you both have talked about Pontius Pilate, and are you aware that he was one of the great writers in keeping records? His Praetorian Guard, who was like the Marine Corps of the time, executed 9 men because they lost the body of Christ at the time of the resurrection, and that's documented in the records of the Guard.
It is true that that Pontius Pilate wrote a report, and he sent it to the Roman Emperor, who was Tiberius at that time. And there was also a document that where he expounded on it that's commonly called the Acts of Pilate. Now, that has been lost, but the Dead Sea Scrolls were lost until they were found. And we do have 4 ancient sources from history that refer to the Acts of Pilate. And we even know that the evidence was so compelling that Emperor Tiberius wanted to classify Jesus as one of the Roman gods, but the Roman Senate outvoted it. You're right. There's many historical evidence. I gave the ones I had time to in the short amount of time we had.
The documents I'm talking about are not from Pilate himself. He libraried them. They're the documents from the sergeant of the guard who ordered the execution of the men and talked about the man that they had lost and the investigation that they couldn't find the body.
Where are those documents found? That one I've not heard of.
I know
that Pilate wrote an extensive thing.
I saw them in Israel.
In Israel, okay. Well, that would be very interesting. I've not come across that in any of the history books I've read, but if that were true, that would also be significant. But I do know that Pontius Pilate himself wrote a record.
Thank you very much. Mr. Thomas, would you like a chance to make a statement or answer to that question?
It's a slightly expanded answer. I'm not completely disputing that there might have been a Jesus Christ who might have even been crucified. But here's an interesting little, slightly different take on the story of the Bible. It goes something like this. Joseph of Arimathea, as you might recall, was the man in whose tomb Jesus was put. Joseph of Arimathea was a rich man. He happened to be a metallurgist. He was a follower of Jesus at the time in the story. So here's a little different take on the death and resurrection of Christ that has a slight twist to it, that actually has evidence in the Bible. It goes like this. Joseph of Arimathea goes up to the Roman guards who are assigned the job of executing Jesus. He says something like this. Hey, guys, you've executed a lot of men before. What would it take? How much money would it take for you not to execute this one man today? So you decide on a price, maybe half now, half afterwards. So the days goes on. It's getting near sunset on Friday. The Sabbath is about to begin on Friday night. It's considered improper to be executing men, even though the Romans weren't necessarily Christians or Jews, excuse me, at the time. So they break the legs of the two other men on the crosses at the time, but they don't break Jesus' leg. This is supposedly because that Jesus was already dead at the time. But it could be that they knew that they didn't really want to kill Jesus. Breaking the legs was considered humane. It allowed the men to die quicker. If they had been bought off by Josephus, there would be ample reason for them not to break Jesus' legs. So it gets on. It's near the end of the day. They take the 3 men down from the cross. Jesus isn't going to open up his eyes if he's still conscious or even alive and say, hey, I ain't dead yet. He's going to go along with it. So Jesus never actually died on the cross. It's much easier for him to actually come back to life. Well, as I said, there's 2 bits of evidence in the Bible that actually support this. One is that Pilate actually mentions later on, he says that the whole crucifixion seemed to have gone off very quickly. I can't quote verse on that, but I know it exists. And 2, the little story of Jesus meeting 2 men on the road later on. What was very big about this? They didn't recognize him. When I was a kid, I was taught about this story. He performed some sort of magic. How about a different take on it? Let's say he's trying to disguise himself, as people would, because there are people out there who would try to kill him if they caught him again. He would want to disguise himself from being caught again. So that's a slightly different take on the supposed death and resurrection of Jesus. Thanks.
Does anybody have any questions for Mr. Thomas? I will take this gentleman right here in the middle.
This is actually kind of a two-part question, and first of all, I was wondering when we... It's kind of a two-part question, and I was wondering, first of all, if you believe that the letters, so as 1 Corinthians, 2 Corinthians, Ephesians, were those historically letters that were traveling around the churches at the time, if you believe that they were, yes or no?
I'm not a biblical expert. As I remember, the Corinthians were written by Paul.
Yes, Paul the Apostle.
Okay, Paul never met Jesus.
Yeah.
That's known. Paul was out proselytizing for Jesus. Now, he never actually met Jesus other than the time when he had some vision when he's walking along the road to...
My question was whether you believe that these were actually letters that might have been circulating around these churches at the time that Paul wrote them, that he did write letters to the Corinthians, and the Corinthians were a people that exists. Actually, it was an isthmus.
As I said, I'm not a biblical scholar. Okay. I can't directly relate to that. I don't think, first of all, as I stated, Paul never met Jesus, so any talking about Jesus is somewhat irrelevant. To him, Jesus was a sky god. Jesus was not a living, human, okay, breathing being.
Okay, because the second part of my question is that when we were talking about written historical evidence, in Corinthians, speaking of the resurrection, in chapter 15, he wrote, for what I received... I passed on to you as of first importance that Christ died for our sins according to the scripture, and that he was buried and that he was raised on the third day according to the scriptures, and that he appeared to Peter and then to the 12, and after that he appeared to more than 500 of the brethren at the same time, most of whom are still living, though some have fallen asleep. And then, of course, afterwards he appears to him as the one untimely born. And if it is a fact that these letters were circulating around in Corinth at that time, could Paul have made a statement of this kind with over 500 living eyewitnesses and not have been totally thrown out and discredited if it were not true?
I've thought about that point a lot. It's easy to say that 500 people saw something yesterday without naming them. If 500, I could tell you, yesterday I talked to 500 people up in San Francisco. You'd have no way to know whether or not I'd actually done it. I could claim it, I could write it down, I could pass it around. You would have no way to verify it. As I said once again, Paul was not an eyewitness. And we were pretty sure that Paul existed. He left behind extensive writings that he existed. Yeah. So Paul is not a reliable witness to any of this.
He can
write these stories. He can write this. It was his belief based on his knowledge of what religion should be, based on probably Mithraism.
What I'm saying is there were 500 people still alive at the time, most of which were still alive at the time he wrote this letter. And if it were not true, wouldn't those people would have came to him and said, you know, Paul, you're a filthy liar, and
which
I don't
people,
even know how you got
people,
here.
Thank you for your question.
Let's give Mr. Thomas 1 minute.
I could claim that I talked to 500 people yesterday. Who are these 500 people? We don't know. So there aren't 500 people out there. There's no way to tell that this is true or not. He could just create it out of nothingness, simply make the claim that it happened with no basis. There wouldn't be, if it didn't happen, there would not be 500 people out there to claim it didn't happen.
Thank you, Mr. Thomas. Mr. Siegel, would you like to take 2 minutes?
Yeah, I'll respond to that. If we're talking about history and we weren't there ourselves, and we're talking about not proof but evidence, what other kind of question would we ask besides how many people were there? I think that was very significant, that 500 people said it, that Paul said it at a time when it could be disproven. And incidentally, back to the last question and this hypothesis of bribing the Roman soldiers, there wasn't enough money to bribe the Roman soldiers. The tomb of Jesus had a Roman seal on it. The penalty for breaking it was death. They could have given them $500, but they wouldn't have been able to spend it. They'd have been dead.
For the future, let's try to keep questions in a minute, not going back and forth. And each candidate's going to have 2 minutes so we can get to the most questions, just so we don't stick back and forth on one question. Questions for Bob. Let's go over here to the far corner.
I can see that I'm not going to be able to direct any questions to Mark because everybody's got their hands, so I'm going to direct this to Bob. Do you not agree that if you were to... There's two philosophies right here. I'm a Christian, and I believe that I'm going to go to heaven forever because of the birth, death, and resurrection of Jesus Christ. This brother over here, if I'm wrong, and you're right, then I really don't have anything to worry about because I'm going to be dead and nothing's ever going to happen. But what I want to ask my brother here is do you not think that it would be terrifying to know that if the millions of people that love Jesus and believe in him and have believed in him through the history of mankind are right, and the thousands and thousands of people that died soon after the death of Christ, within years of the death of Christ, were thrown before lions and everything else because they would not deny the death and resurrection of Christ, would you not lay in your bed every night and be terrified that if they're right, you're going to spend an eternity in misery beyond anything that you can comprehend on this earth today? I would be terrified if I was in that man's shoes.
Two minutes.
Let me respond to that, because I think I know what Mark's going to say. That's commonly called Pascal's wager, that if you're wrong, you've got more to lose than I have to lose if I'm wrong. And that's true. That's absolutely true. But the purpose of this debate was to see if there was evidence. So I can understand why that would not necessarily appeal to Mark. Mark did say something about hell, though, that I want to say. The Bible says we're made in the image of God, and that means his standards is in our conscience. And we can look at our societies and see that we believe in something very much like hell. It's called prison and the courtroom system. If a judge let a murderer or rapist go free and did not lock him up, at the very least, we would consider him an irresponsible and therefore unloving judge. I always hear, how could a loving God send people to hell? Hell is a prison. It's not necessarily a place where people burn. I know Jesus used a fiery image, but the word he used was Gehenna. That was an actual garbage dump in Palestine. And it may have just been Jesus' way of saying, if you don't do what you were created to do, you're going to end up in the trash heap. But what we do know is that hell is a place where people will be separated from God because that is what they chose. What do human beings crave? Paradise. A place where we can go where there is no more evil. I know Mark would love to believe in a thing like that. He said he'd like to. He doesn't, but he'd like to. Well, if there were a paradise and God let evil into paradise, he wouldn't be much of a God. So a loving God would send people to hell, but he would give them the choice as to where they want to live.
Mark, would you like to take 2 minutes on that subject?
Yeah, what he was referring to is Pascal's wager. It's basically that you have to bet on God existing or not existing. And therefore, you should bet on God because you got the best deal. Because if God doesn't exist, what the heck? That has several inadequacies that will take a while to explain, and I don't want to get into it. Basically, it doesn't prove any God. It just proves that some God might be there who's going to damn you to hell. And if you're going to take that, you should pick whatever God is giving out the worst hell, because that's the hell you want to avoid. It's not really an argument for the existence of God. It's merely an argument for belief, which is not what we're arguing tonight.
Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Thomas? I'll go all the way in the back. Like this. There you go.
Can I hold it?
Hi.
I had a question for Mark. I'm a Christian. And my question for you is, as this guy I said over here, I don't remember his name, he had mentioned that like there is some sort of purpose to his life, and I have a purpose. I have a purpose for believing in God. I have a purpose because I'm going to go to heaven, and you know, I have a purpose for believing that God has grace on me and God is good and God is all these things that I believe that are in the Bible. What is the purpose behind believing there is no God? Like, you've explained that you don't believe in one, but what is the purpose behind believing there is no one? Is it just so you can make your own decisions and not have to worry about anything, or what's the purpose?
Purpose is a human construct. We create purpose in our minds, and that's good. That's what keeps us going every day. Atheism, to me, isn't a purpose per se. It's a conclusion based on the evidence that I see around me. It's very nice that you believe in a God. A God gives you purpose. To me, I don't see that. I look at the universe around me, and I see some amazing things that I just find astounding. Let's take a look at a couple images here that I brought along. That'd be a lot of fun. Let's take a look at slide 22. This is a Hubble Deep Field. No, that's the whales. This is the evolution of the whales that we're showing right there. Here's the Hubble Deep Field image. That may not look like much, but every little speck on there, just about every little speck, is another whole galaxy, much like ours. This is a Hubble Deep Field that was taken over about 14 days of the Hubble looking at an area space about the size of grain of rice held out at arm's length. There we're seeing galaxies, many of them very primitive. We're looking far back in time. To me, this is astounding that we as a species who have only been relatively scientifically working for a few hundred years can look into the universe and get this while orbiting a small star and a medium-sized galaxy. This astounds me. There's many other things that astound me, but purpose, once again, is a human construct, and we create it out of our minds. Does that answer your question sufficiently?
Thank you. Bob, you have 2 minutes if you'd like.
Yeah, it amazes me, too. We're fearfully and wonderfully made, the things that human beings are capable of doing. I do find it very amazing what we're able to do in science, and that ought not surprise us since the Bible says we are made in God's image. But as far as purpose being a human construct, if we invented purpose, then we invented morality. If we invented morality, then two accidents can disagree on morality at any time. And I would ask Mark if he believes that it's a legitimate option to disagree on whether slavery is wrong, because he's made it very clear he doesn't believe slavery is wrong. Can we disagree on whether rape is wrong? He's made it very clear he doesn't believe that rape is wrong. I would ask him if he believes it's wrong for everybody or if it's just an opinion that it's wrong and it's just as valid otherwise. These are the questions we have to ask ourselves when we're asking ourselves if we have value and purpose. If we invented purpose and morality, then purpose and morality doesn't really exist except in our own mind. If we didn't invent it, then we need to obey it, and it is evidence that we have a purpose. And if you're an accident, you can't have a purpose. That's what accident means. I'm sorry, I didn't do that on purpose. It was an accident.
Time.
But we don't live as though we're accidents.
I have a question for Bob. Right here in the Chargers jersey.
I'll hold the mic. They told me not to give it up.
Of course, I understand. It could be dangerous. Some of us have heard in the news today that the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals came up with a ruling that within the public schools it is now, and this is not the first ruling of these courts, that the Pledge of Allegiance with the phrase "under God" is unconstitutional. And I just wanted both of your comments on that particular ruling.
This is absolutely amazing to me. You know the kind of stuff that goes on in schools these days? I don't even have to list them for you. And we're worried that the word God might be mentioned. It's gotten so ridiculous that, you know, there are places where you're not allowed to say Merry Christmas in the workplace, where you can't wear a red sweater because it'll remind people of Christmas. This is not what our forefathers had in mind. And I know not all the forefathers were Christians. Thomas Jefferson was a deist. Ben Franklin was a deist. That was a different kind of belief in God. But they didn't think Christianity did any harm. Our Constitution says Congress shall make no law concerning the establishment of a religion or exercising its freedom thereof. Excuse me. What difference does that make, sir? Okay, well, okay.
Let's.
We have to talk one at a time. We have to talk one at a time. So I'm happy to respond, but we got to actually listen to the response. I do not see the harm that is being done. I was an atheist myself for many years. I didn't give a hang if I saw a cross on Mount Soledad or a cross around someone's neck or somebody said, "God bless you," if you sneeze. What our forefathers had in mind was that we were not going to be like Europe. We were not going to have a state church. We were not going to make people be Christians against their will. Nobody here in this room is being forced to be a Christian. The fact that we're having a debate about it, who's waiting for you outside to shoot you because you said that you weren't a Christian? Nobody. This is a lot of hullabaloo over absolutely nothing. The idea that there's this evangelical conspiracy to take over the country.
30 seconds.
We've been saying the Pledge of Allegiance for years, and when was anybody in America ever forced against their will to be a Christian? And I'm saying that as one who was a Jew for the first 20 years of his life. No one forced me. I just had an encounter with God.
I'm going to let Mr. Thomas rebuttal that. We'll then take one more question for Mr. Thomas so the questions are even, and then we will call it an even.
I need to rebut that.
Yes, you have 2 minutes to rebuttal that.
First of all, we're not here arguing whether or not, that's a whole separate debate. whether or not God, Christianity or religion and government should be separate. But I will respond to that. First of all, our forefathers very well understood what happened when you combine religion and government. They had seen it. Europe had seen religious wars for many years. That's why they very carefully put in Article 6 of the Constitution that no religious requirement shall be put forth for any official. That's why they made the First Amendment, that Congress shall make no law respecting establishment of religion. What part of no law don't you understand? It's empirical for religious freedom, for all of us to believe in what we, to have the right to believe or not believe in what we want, to have true religious freedom. For the government to come down and mandate that kids have to say, under God, is definitely a religious point, and I think violates separation of government and religion that is so important in the First Amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Thomas.
Okay, one more thing. Okay. He put forth that Thomas Jefferson was not anti-Christian. Thomas Jefferson is known for being very anti-Christian. He created his own Bible where he ripped out much of what he didn't like. There are many, many quotes by him. Let's see, probably one of the biggest one is, Christianity is the most perverted system that ever shone on man. That was Thomas Jefferson.
30 seconds to finish.
Here's another one. The Christian God is a being of terrific character. Terrific meaning terrible in the old sense. Cruel, vindictive, capricious, and unjust. He also talks about shake off the fears of servile prejudices and question with boldness even the existence of God. He also talks about the day will come when the mythical generation of Jesus by the supreme being as his father in the womb of a virgin will be classified with the fable of the generation of Minerva in the brain of Jupiter.
And that's your time. Thank you. And we're going to take one final question for Mr. Thomas.
You going to let me talk?
Yes.
All right. Now, this is for you, Mark. I got the mic, so I just want to ask you one quick question. You were disputing Bob that morality comes from basic human kindness. You said God didn't create morality. It's not from the, you know, commandments. It's from basic human kindness. Now, I'm a youth pastor. I work with a lot of teenagers. I've never seen too many of them with basic human kindness. Now, they're taught morality. I have a 2-year-old nephew. When someone takes something from him, his basic human kindness is to bite that person, that little baby. My sister taught him morality, not to do that. Morality comes through teaching, which comes from maturity based off of what people's parents teach them, not something that's basic human kindness.
Thank you. Mr. Thomas, you have 2 minutes.
Yeah, I agree with you. I mean, we need to learn morality. We learn that when we hurt somebody, now, humans don't, we're not born as sentient beings. Babies obviously don't understand much. Our brains take a long time to develop. I remember when I was a kid, I killed a little mouse with a BB gun. It's horrible to think back on this memory. It's something I couldn't do now as an adult. Morality, empathy grows as our brains develop. You talk about teenagers. They haven't developed that kind of maturity yet. We don't allow teenagers to do certain things that are dangerous because we know they're not very good at understanding consequences. It's a process where our brains grow over time that morality comes out of. Would you rather choose a morality out of a Bible that advocates killing people because he doesn't like them, because he's mad at them? This is the Bible. This is a Bible where the God has his own son brutally murdered in this story just because he thinks that some sort of sacrifice needs to be made to himself. I would think that a supreme being could have come up with a little bit better story, better way to absolve the supposed sins of other people. I think it's a brutal, horrendous story. I look at The Passion of the Christ as a Christian snuff movie. I've seen parts of it. It's a horrible movie to watch. It's gut-wrenching to me as one who cares about other people, who has empathy. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Thomas. Mr. Siegel.
It is horrible dying on a cross. Jesus made that choice himself to do that for us and for our selfish natures. Back to the thing about the killing, because Mark's mentioned it several times. The nations that God commanded to kill were guilty of some of the things that Mark has protested tonight. They used to take babies and offer them on the altar to their Baal fertility gods. And it was because of that evil that God wanted the nations displaced. They did not, however, wipe out and destroy every man, woman, and child and annihilate them, because if you just keep reading and you get to the book of 1 Chronicles chapter 8, you find that all those nations are still there hanging out. They were displaced as a nation. When the Soviet Union was destroyed, we said there is no Soviet Union. That doesn't mean there aren't still Russians, okay? Now, getting back to the morality, it's true that we're taught morality. We also have a conscience that's part of our DNA. It grows, it adapts, just as we have a genetic code for being able to walk, or we have a genetic code for feet, we have a genetic code for our conscience. And it is true that people were taught and taught and taught and taught, but the first person had to get taught. It had to come from somewhere. And once again, if it did not come from God, then we just invented it and we don't have to obey it. And not one person in this room believes that rape, murder in cold blood, slavery, racism is something that we can just have a difference of opinion of. Finally, back to the Constitution, what part of not forbidding the exercise thereof do we not understand either? This is not freedom for somebody to just never be offended. We say that we don't allow Christianity in secular schools, and yet professors get up and not Christianity all the time. How come it doesn't work the other way? They can get up and say anything they want about Jesus, but if a student defends him, a discussion of Jesus doesn't belong in the public school. If it doesn't belong in the public school, don't talk about it. If you're going to talk about it in an institution of higher learning, show both sides. Thank you very much.